Welcome to the First Things Podcast. On this week's episode, Matthew Rose will talk to us about death of God theology. He'll explain why the most Christian person is the post-Christian person. Then I'll interview Rusty Reno about his new book, Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society. He'll explain the difference between the democratic era we're leaving and the meritocratic one we're entering. Finally, I'll gather all my colleagues for a game of Stump the Editors. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. Joined by First Things editor Rusty Reno, and also by Matthew Rose. Matt is director and senior fellow at the Berkeley Institute. He holds a PhD in religious studies from the University of Chicago, and once upon a time he was an editorial assistant here at First Things. He's one of our wittiest and most learned writers, and we're happy to have him Skyping in from Berkeley, California. Matt, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
The audio for Matt might be less than optimal, but we will muddle through. So, Matt Rose, one of the most popular items in our August-September issue is your feature essay on death of God theology. You begin by describing the Time magazine cover that shocked the world in 1966, all black, with the question, "Is God dead?" in red. That cover story featured three theologians on the cutting edge of death of God theology. It elicited a lot of angry resistance. It made the death of God theologians infamous rather than famous. But you argue it has turned out to be prescient. If I read you right, yes, God is dead in the sense these theologians meant. So, Matt, what was or is death of God theology? What did its advocates mean by saying that God was dead? And what do you mean by saying that they were right?
The Death of God theologians were a group of Protestant thinkers working in the 50s and 60s, largely at Protestant seminaries in the United States. They're a group of Protestant thinkers who were attempting, really, to give a kind of radical Christian interpretation of what we would now call secularization. Now, they got their name from a famous passage in a book authored by Friedrich Nietzsche, who in a book called The Gate Science notoriously announced that God is dead. Now, when Nietzsche used the phrase God is dead, what he meant is that modern Western people are slowly realizing that religious belief is increasingly marginal to their lives. Now, when the Death of God theologians use that phrase, they use it in a slightly different way than Nietzsche meant, but they use it in a way that's recognizably similar. So who are the Death of God theologians? Well, they attained a kind of instant notoriety for announcing not that Christians should dispute or try to rebut this claim that God is dead, but they argued that Christians should affirm this claim. They should affirm this claim, in fact, as an expression of deep and mature Christian faith.
So the idea here is that the faithlessness of our era is paradoxically the fulfillment of faith.
That's exactly right. The Death of God theologians, they're trying to make an interpretation of the weakening of belief in the central Christian articles of faith. And what they do is they make a kind of novel and radical interpretive move. And under the kind of dispensation of modern thought in which Christianity becomes criticized, Christians are being led to see what Christian faith really, really meant all along, which is that Christian faith is not about possessing knowledge about God. It's not about attaining salvation in the world to come, but rather, for the Death of God theologians, that Christianity was essentially about inaugurating a new way of life, a new way of life that somehow breaks down every possible barrier to inclusion, including barriers that are founded on rival beliefs.
So essentially, the most Christian person is the post-Christian person. Is that correct?
Yeah, I really like your phrase there, Julia. The most Christian person is the post-Christian person. And I think that's a kind of religious sensibility or a kind of a religious demand that a lot of us now today feel, which is that a mark of living an authentically Christian life is a kind of willingness to expose yourself to unending self-criticism, maybe even a kind of religious self-humiliation. That's right. And if you see the kind of essence of Christianity being a kind of self-denying love, then you can come to see that the Death of God theologians are exponents of a theological view that is still very much with us.
Yeah, I think, a lot of people think that multiculturalism is kind of an anti-Western approach. But I've come to realize that it fits with exactly the dynamic you're describing. Mm. I mean, what could be more exemplary of a Christian culture than a culture that's willing to open itself up to perpetual critique and a kind of crucifixion, if you will, of cultural authority for the sake of faithfulness to that culture?
I think that's exactly right. That's exactly right, Russ. And that's why a kind of forgotten story about a group of radical theologians in the 50s and 60s is actually remarkably a kind of theologically fresher, it seems to me, that they simply said out loud and articulated with kind of abrupt and stunning explicitness what a lot of us really today feel, which is that to be a Christian is to open yourself up to criticisms and challenges that other traditions don't.
One of the phrases that you used in your article, you said that the Death of God theologians had anticipated the institutional defeat, but cultural victory, I think you put it, of liberal Protestantism. So that seems to be the sense in which they were very prescient, and we are sort of living in the world that they declared on that Time magazine cover in 1966.
Yeah, to me, the most interesting and most difficult to explain religious phenomena is the apparent disappearance of the mainline churches and liberal Protestantism in the 20th century. I use the word apparent because it's not entirely clear to me that this institution did disappear.
Right, not to make dogmatic claims that give you certainty, which is the comfort of knowing that you have the truth. But you have to live this vulnerable, open life that's outwardly turned to others, et cetera, et cetera. I think you're right. That's been hugely influential over the last couple of generations. You go to universities and people really emphasize open-mindedness as the great virtue. And I think that fits with what these guys were trying to argue was the essence of Christianity.
Matt, I wanted to ask you about your interpretation of Bonhoeffer. When Bonhoeffer was in prison writing his letters, he elucidated some theological ideas that later became very important to the Death of God theologians. And I was wondering a bit how you would classify Bonhoeffer. Was he himself a Death of God theologian or proto-Death of God theologian, or was he being misappropriated by this later generation?
I think it's not right to call Bonhoeffer a Death of God theologian, but it's simply undeniable that he was really influential on this trio of thinkers. Let me start by saying Bonhoeffer probably just died too young, too early, for us to figure out exactly what he had to say. His most cryptic and his most kind of explosive ideas about the decline of religious faith in the West are found in his letters and papers from prison. Bonhoeffer's ideas at the end of his life, I think, are simply not entirely clear. One thing is clear, Bonhoeffer is not an atheist. Bonhoeffer certainly believes in biblical religion and biblical revelation. But as to how Bonhoeffer saw Christianity existing in modern Western secular societies, that's an interesting question that I'm not sure I'm prepared to answer. So what direction Bonhoeffer would have moved towards the end of the 20th century? Would he have moved in a more radical direction or a possibly more Catholic direction? I think that's an open question.
Yeah, it's an open question and one that I think is of interest to a lot of people who would sort of like to claim him for whatever trend they're sort of advancing at a given moment.
Bonhoeffer is something of a Rorschach test.
Right.
People read him lots of different directions. But Matt, wouldn't you, think about, isn't it kind of convenient for Altizer, Van Buren, and Hamilton to declare that, you know, a secular way of life is the true Christian way of life at precisely the moment that that the institutional churches that they were parts of were faltering?
I think it's tempting to say that these theologians were making a virtue of necessity.
Although, in all fairness, you know, these books came out in the early 60s, right? So they were gestated in the late 50s.
That's right.
And that was a time when a lot of mainline Protestants were thought they were just going to move from strength to strength. So I guess I'm being unfair.
I think you're being slightly unfair because it's tempting for us to kind of project backwards the theological seriousness of people on the political and progressive left. I mean, make no mistake, the progressive religious movement was a deeply theologically and spiritually serious social movement and intellectual movement in American culture. It wouldn't have informed us to the degree and depth that it does today if these people hadn't been animated at a deep personal and institutional level with this theology.
Matt, what is your interpretation of Pope Francis? Is he a death of God theologian?
I would want to think about that question a little bit more, but let me take a first cut at it. I think Francis would refuse the false choice posed by the death of God theologians, and here's what I mean by that. I think Francis would reject as a false choice that you have to either believe in a supernatural God or be committed to radical human solidarity. I think that's a false choice for Francis. And it also has to be said, it's a false choice that has been bequeathed to us, I think, by modern theology. It would have never occurred to an Augustine or Aquinas that our love of humanity has to somehow compete with the love for God.
Final question. With the rise of death of God theology and the triumphant self-emptying of liberal mainline Protestantism, have we reached the end of Nietzsche's prophecy of the demise of Western civilization? Are we the last men?
I like that question a lot. I think the answer is we're close, but we're not quite. By the last men, I think Nietzsche meant a people or a culture who had lost some vision of what human greatness or human nobility required. And so to be living in the culture of the last men meant that you were living in a culture that really no longer strove for some kind of great artistic or political goals. When Nietzsche looks around and he sees the birth of secular liberalism and secular democracies, he doesn't see something opposed to Christianity. He sees a kind of off-brand Christian, a kind of an off-brand Christianity still that lurked in the world. And make no mistake, for Nietzsche, the death of God is a catastrophe, because it removes any high goals or any high purposes for Western culture. And he thinks the most important event yet to come in Western history is when Western people will learn to invent new goals and new ideals that get us beyond Christianity. But so long as we're sitting here talking about inclusion or multiculturalism or a global humanistic culture, so long as we're still talking in that idiom, we're still Christians.
So we're not the last men. That's kind of comforting. Matt, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Great to talk to you as always.
Rusty Reno's new book is Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society. It begins rather alarmingly. Our country is entering a crisis. Globalization has eroded the wages of middle-class workers. Mass culture normalizes dysfunctional behavior. People are either winners or losers, and there's ever less in between. Everything, it seems, is fluid, mobile, and impermanent. The title of the book echoes T.S. Eliot's The Idea of a Christian Society, written in 1939 when Nazism, fascism, and communism were ascendant on the European continent, Eliot saw that the fundamental question was, would the West seek a Christian future or a pagan one? And Rusty, you see contemporary American society is facing a similar decision. More specifically, or perhaps this is just one aspect of the decision we face, you say that America is leaving behind the democratic era and heading toward a meritocratic one. What does that mean, and why does it matter?
Yeah, it's hard to see this transition, I think, clearly, because obviously, you know, we still have elections, and we have a society with democratic political institutions. But the foundation of a democratic culture is the sense that everyone is in some sense has a basis for self-government and can contribute to the common good. And it seems to me that as our society fragments into a kind of functional upper part, and Charles Murray really brings this out in Coming Apart, his important 2012 book, and an increasingly dysfunctional bottom third and a very anxious middle, that the basis for a democratic culture is very much eroded. And the temptation is for a kind of meritocratic elite to become a paternalistic technocracy, a paternalistic ruling class that delivers the goodies for the struggling masses while it pursues what it thinks are the best policies, not just for the country, but for the whole globe.
What do you perceive as being the moral and spiritual consequences of that development?
Well, when I talk about the pagan temptation or the pagan trajectory, it's not Nazism, it's not George Orwell, 1984, it's much more Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. It's our paganism revolves around the gods of health, wealth, and pleasure. And these gods are, you know, they promise happiness, obviously, if we serve them. And those gods are materialistic, not in the narrow sense of, you know, wanting, well, the wealth god clearly is that in the narrow sense, but in the metaphysical sense of saying that the meaning of human life is purely this worldly. Right. And so we health and wealth and pleasure are different dimensions of a kind of this worldly trajectory for life. And it seems to me that a Christian society encourages us to see life as ordered to something greater than what is available in this world, and that therefore it transfigures and ennobles our this worldly activities. It's not anti-worldly, but it is one that preserves an element of transcendence. And that strikes me as what's lacking in our moment. It's just why we feel so trapped politically in a lot of our political debates. We feel like we've kind of reached a dead end, and that tomorrow can only be today plus one. And that sense of political frustration or political entrapment, I don't quite know how to describe it, is one important dimension of our current political distemper in our society.
Related to your argument about our move toward meritocracy is a theme that occupies you in this book and elsewhere, and that is the disciplined hedonism of the well-to-do. You know, so whereas the benefits of economic freedom do indeed often trickle down from the rich to the poor, the benefits of lifestyle freedom do not. Instead, the downsides do. They fall much harder on the poor than on the rich. Can you explain how that works? And I'll suggest three examples so that we can observe this process concretely. Marital norms, euthanasia, marijuana.
Right. It's easier probably to start from the particular and move up. Mm-hmm. It's the most complicated argument I think I make in the book, is an attempt to show that what looks innocent, which is to say an expansion of lifestyle freedoms, actually comes at a very high cost for those on the bottom of society. So let's start with marijuana, because it's the kind of least controversial. It just seems obvious to many people that nobody's dying from marijuana overdoses. It's not closely tied to crime in the way that hard drugs are. So why not legalize marijuana? It would reduce criminalization of a very common practice. So we should accept it and normalize it. But the problem is that people's brains don't work that way. They see that we tend to think wholesale, not retail. And so the message in drug legalization, marijuana legalization, is that drug use, while it may be unhealthy, is not wrong. And so this can seduce vulnerable people into a life of drug use that accelerates and becomes more and more self-destructive, and ultimately leads to, as we know, an epidemic of death through drug overdose that's seemingly unrelenting and increasingly a problem throughout the country, especially among poor communities. So you've got somebody living in Westchester County, their kids, well, they're really, you know, you've got Bill Clinton. He did not inhale, he said, which is really a code for, yes, I used, but I used responsibly. And this is something that folks who are clear about their life goals and the importance of serving the health gods and the wealth god will moderate their obedience to the pleasure god. But people whose life are not so well ordered, they didn't have parents who got them moving in the right direction, they tend to ping off of those gods or become particularly seduced by one of them and not the other. And so they can fall into very self-destructive patterns of life. Or we know that statistically the state in which there was the highest increase in suicide, and it falls heavily on unemployed men between the ages of 35 and 55, was Oregon. And that increase, it went up 50% over the decade after their legalization of doctor-assisted suicide. So we're constantly sending messages that set normalize behavior that can be very harmful to people. And then marriage norms is a good example. You know, in well-to-do society, out-of-wedlock birth is extremely rare. For all we see, all we read about these Hollywood stars is extremely rare, something like 3%. But the very same people are keen to enforce a kind of politically correct language that will only speak of non-traditional families, for instance. So there's an unwillingness to transmit to our culture at large the very norms that are in subtle ways imposed upon their own children.
Yeah, and you argue that having sort of rigid categorical norms is much more important for the lower and working classes than it is for the ascendant and disciplined bourgeoisie. And you talk about Mary Douglas.
Right. That was a very transformative book for me, Natural Symbols, which she wrote in the late 1960s. And she really she recognized that the rebellions of the 60s were a top-down rebellion against strict moral norms, not a bottom-up rebellion. And especially the relaxing of the Friday fast for Catholics, which she, as a raised Catholic herself, in a working class family, recognized was an important identity marker around which often Irish immigrant Catholics in a hostile Protestant world used as a kind of touchstone for identity. And the bishops who agreed to lift that fast in England were typically upper middle class and they thought it was, you know, they didn't want ritualized, unsophisticated Catholicism. They wanted people to take personal possession of their faith and not merely follow rules. Pope Francis talks that way a lot too now. And she recognizes the way in which this is kind of a class war against a working class culture that is, you know, when you're in a vulnerable environment, you need guardrails. So when the streets are slippery and icy, you need guardrails. When it's a sunny weather and there's no danger, maybe you don't need the guardrails. Well, if you're well-to-do and you have a lot of social capital behind you, a lot of verbal intelligence, you can talk through your problems, you can kind of, somebody says make healthy choices, and you can kind of do these elaborate calculations and reflective analysis. But if you're careening through life, you know, trying to meet your bills and hold your family together, this is kind of a luxury that I think a lot of people who struggle on the lower end of society can't afford, or they don't have the aptitude for it, and it puts them at a tremendous disadvantage. So at precisely the time when our economic system is being transformed by globalization in a way that people like me, who are like very well educated and credentialed, flourish, at the very same moment when sort of the upper middle class is receiving an especially advantageous position in a global marketplace, we are also having a kind of cultural marketplace where the upper middle class is at a distinct advantage. We see this with the way in which there's a rhetoric out there that's a kind of punching down against the simple-minded bigots or what have you. So I can imagine, you know, let's just imagine the PTA meeting or the meeting with the local school officials, and some mother objects to having her fourth grade daughter taught about explicit sexual relations, and or they object to some discussion of homosexuality, saying it's not appropriate that a 10-year-old talk about sex. And I can imagine the school principal or the executive director of the local school board saying, "Well, Mrs. Jones, you know, we're committed to building an inclusive environment here at the Stony Brook Elementary School, and your approach is really not very healthy." And so this kind of language, inclusive, healthy, is a kind of therapeutic language that really removes most people from having a say in public life.
Yeah, I think we can apprehend that even more vividly by considering, you use the word appropriate, you know, imagining that the woman's objection would be, it's
inappropriate.
Not appropriate. There's no way such a woman would actually use that word. She would come to the table
wrong.
With a different idiom, right?
Wrong.
Or backward, or what have you.
Yes.
And she would be dismissed on the basis of her idiom. She doesn't know how to talk.
Right.
She doesn't know how to have these conversations.
Healthy, appropriate, these are terms that get used a lot. And appropriate is really beautiful because it's an etiquette word. And so what you really say when you say, "Well, I'm sorry, Tom, but in this class we can't talk that way," it's inappropriate for you to say that homosexuality is wrong. What you're really saying is that you don't belong in the upper middle class. You're not socialized. You don't have the proper etiquette. So we have a kind of transformation of morality into etiquette and a transformation of morality into hygiene with the notion of health, healthy choices, healthy, you know, you have to have a healthy attitude towards sex. So really, sex and hygiene are in the same category, or an appropriate attitude. Sex and what utensils you used at the table are in the same category.
Your overall verdict seems to be that the bad news is our society is falling apart, and the good news is our society is falling apart. Can you explain that?
Nobody, I think, could be happy with the way in which all sorts of institutions in our society are increasingly troubled. We know from polling data that trust in Congress, trust in schools, trust in all sorts of institutions in our country has declined a great deal. And now we have two political candidates that have record high disapproval ratings, and the election seems going to be to turn on who you like least.
Yeah.
so nothing can be, that's not good for a country. But I do think that for Christians who wish to restore a Christian leaven to our public culture, who feel very much that the current is going against us, I think we need to recognize that those institutions that are being discredited are by and large in the control of this materialist worldview. Universities are the most obvious example of that. And so it does suggest that the public at large is unhappy with the post-Christian regime. And there's an opportunity there, I think, to speak clearly, charitably, but clearly about what we believe, with some confidence that the time may come when, sooner than we expect, when people are willing to listen.
The book, again, is R.R. Reno's Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society. We have a nifty little page at firstthings.com that introduces the book and provides an Amazon link. Visit early and often.
Thanks, Julia.
Now for the last thing on this episode of the First Things podcast. I've gathered Rusty Reno, senior editor Mark Bauerlein, and literary editor Matthew Schmitz for a game of Name That Author, or Source That Passage, or Stump the Editors. I'll read a passage from literature, and my colleagues will try to guess the author of the passage, and listeners, you can try to beat them to it. I have three passages here. They all contain lists. And they're all drawn from Francis Spufford's The Chatto Book of Cabbages and Kings, which is a very charming anthology of lists in literature. Everyone ready?
Putting on my thinking cap.
So I read passage, you guess author. Here's a list of the reputed Catholic horrors in the cellar of the oratory. There might have been flitting notions, misgivings, rumors, voices, that the horrors of the Inquisition were from time to time renewed in our subterranean chambers, and 50 years hence, if some sudden frenzy of the hour roused the anti-Catholic jealousy still lingering in the town, a mob might have swarmed about our innocent dwelling to rescue certain legs of mutton and pats of butter from imprisonment, and to hold an inquest over a dozen packing cases, some old hampers, a knife board, and a range of empty blacking bottles. Name that author.
John Henry Newman?
Monk Lewis?
Someone very obscure, not an important author. No one I've ever heard of, I'm sure.
It is John Henry Newman.
Well done, Chief.
Come on, it's kind of cheating when you give me a theological author.
Or one in which I tell you that it's all about the cellar of the oratory.
That was a bit of a giveaway.
So he's evoking British Protestant fantasies, what was really going on in the oratory that he'd established in Birmingham. And this passage comes from his Lectures on the Present Position of Catholics from 1851. And that particular lecture has a lot more in it that's very satirical. Point for Reno. The following passage contains a list of non-books.
Hmm.
I have no repugnances. I can read anything which I call a book. But there are things in that shape which I cannot allow for such. In this catalogue of books which are no books, Biblia, ah, Biblia, I reckon court calendars, directories, pocketbooks, draft boards bound and lettered at the back, scientific treatises, almanacs, statutes at large, the works of Hume, Gibbon, Robertson, Beatty, Soame Jenyns, and generally all those volumes which, quote, no gentleman's library should be without, unquote, the histories of Flavius Josephus, that learned Jew, and Paley's Moral Philosophy. With these exceptions, I can read almost anything. I bless my stars for a taste so Catholic, so unexcluding. I confess that it moves my spleen to see these things in books' clothing perched upon shelves, like false saints, usurpers of true shrines, intruders into the sanctuary, thrusting out the legitimate occupants. To reach down a well-bound semblance of a volume and hope it is some kind-hearted playbook, then, opening what seem its leaves, to come bolt upon a withering population essay, to expect a Steele or a Farquhar and find Adam Smith. Name that author.
Wow. I'm thinking Lord Macaulay. But I think Macaulay liked Adam Smith and didn't dislike Adam Smith, so I'm probably wrong.
This is a guess from the same time. John Stuart Mill?
No, it's not Adam Smith. So every gentleman's library should have a copy of...
Gentleman.
Of Charles Lamb in it. Maybe it's Charles Lamb.
No.
Coleridge?
Walter Bagot?
Bagot,
sorry. I knew you said you were going to correct mispronunciations.
That's what I'm here for. Good guesses all. The author is the great romantic essayist Charles Lamb.
Mr. Schmitz, well done.
It's from Last Essays of Elia in 1822. This third passage contains a list of the ornaments of the daughters of Zion.
Moreover, the Lord saith, because the daughters of Zion are haughty, and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, and making a tinkling with their feet. Therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will discover their secret parts. In that day the Lord will take away the bravery of their tinkling ornaments about their feet, and their calls, and their round tires like the moon, the chains and the bracelets and the mufflers, the bonnets and the ornaments of the legs, and the headbands and the tablets and the earrings, the rings and nose jewels, the changeable suits of apparel, and the mantles and the wimples and the crisping pins, the glasses and the fine linen, and the hoods and the veils. And it shall come to pass that instead of sweet smell there shall be stink, and instead of a girdle, a rent, and instead of well-set hair, baldness, and instead of a stomacher, a girding of sackcloth, and burning instead of beauty. Name that author.
Ezekiel.
William Blake.
Oh, good call, Mark.
Prophetic.
Certain anti-Zionism in the passage, but I don't think... Edward Said could write anything like that. maybe one of the prophets. We have Ezekiel and Jeremiah.
That was a reading from the prophet Isaiah.
Oh.
Chapter 3, verses 16 through 24, King James Version.
Well, I guess this is a Catholic crowd, and we can't get our scripture quotations when they're given to us.
We don't read the Bible. All right, how about one bonus passage?
Okay, great.
Please.
Mark, maybe you can catch up here. This passage contains a list of the contents of Rat's picnic basket. There's cold chicken inside, said Rat. Cold tongue, cold ham, cold beef, pickled onions, salad, French bread, cresson, widge-spotted meat, ginger beer, lemonade. Oh, stop, cried Mole in ecstasy. This is too much.
A.A. Noun. Right, isn't that the Wind in the Willows author?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. My son just read it. Or is it the Peter Rabbit?
Ooh. No, it's not. You're right. I think it is Peter Rabbit. Rat, Mole.
No, that's Wind in the Willows.
Is it Wind in the Willows?
Yeah.
Am I wrong, A. A. Milne?
Yes.
I am wrong.
Kenneth Graham.
Yes.
One for Mark. All right, well done.
I got slipped a note under my desk by my colleague.
Kenneth Graham, author of Wind in the Willows.
Well, there's a proper humiliation in all of this, isn't there?
So that's the ball game with the score Reno 1, Bauerline 1, Schmitz 1. And the book again is Francis Spufford's Chateau Book of Cabbages and Kings, a volume that no gentleman's library should be without.
Agreed.
Oh, bad guess on Ezekiel.
That's it for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to Matthew Rose for Skyping in all the way from California. Thanks to Rusty Reno, Mark Bauerlein, and Matthew Schmitz. And thank you, listeners. We'll do it again next week.